going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for coming tonight on such a nice day. First one we've had in a while.
About 50 people have gathered for an evening lecture at the Smoky Hill Museum in Salina, Kansas. The granite and marble building is an old post office from the 1930s.
Our mission is to honor, to educate, and to inspire all Kansans through the history of Kansas sports. And we preserve the rich stories and heritage of the state's athletic history.
The funding for this event comes from the Kansas Humanities Council, which is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Kathy Tinkler and Barbara Archer live in the nearby town of Assyria. They're both retired, and they think these lectures are a good use of public funds.
Well, I think people are informed by what they talk about. And I've learned a lot. Don't you agree? We've learned a lot that we didn't know before we started coming.
But it may not be a given that retirees in western Kansas will have opportunities like this in the future. Or if they do, the funding will likely have to come from other sources. The National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts are both earmarked for $0 in the 2018 budget released by the Trump administration in March. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're taking a look at how the potential elimination of the NEA and the NEH might affect the country by zeroing in on how Kansas has fared through Governor Brownback's administration. Brownback famously shut down the state's Arts Commission in 2011. The New York Times is calling Brownback's Kansas a test case for art in a public funding vacuum. If you live in Kansas, particularly a rural area or small town, I'd love your take on this. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Let's start by talking to someone in Hays, Kansas, someone profiled in that Times article. Branda Mader is the executive director and only employee of the Hays Arts Council. Hi, Branda.
Good morning.
So you are the quintessential one-woman show. Describe the range of your responsibilities at the Hays Arts Council.
Well, first, I do want to clarify, there is a part-time assistant at the gallery for administrative and office management purposes, but I do the primary scope of things. So developing the exhibitions, hanging the exhibitions, setting the lights, hanging the work, tagging it, preparing for our two major art competitions, one statewide, one regional with five states, developing the arts education programs that we do to serve 12 elementary schools in five different towns and three different counties, taking performing arts to them, bringing them into a performing arts center, a creative writing contest, famous figures, developing any sort of special events and things like that that might go on, organizing art classes for both adults and an extensive summer youth art program, as well as prepping the things that we have for receptions to avoid some of the, you know, catering costs, putting together the invitations before they go to print, organizing all the site components as well as the features that are part of our four seasonal art walks. The first one we're getting ready for here, in fact, the end of April, which will have about 28 or 29 locations on it. So we're active and very busy.
So, but your role, I mean, the range of things you do, has that always been the range of things you've done in this position?
For the most part, it has. We've never had more than two full-time employees. And we did have two for a number of years. And so the things that I've been doing just have become maybe a little bit more compounded. And of course, over that time, there are some new programs that maybe have been developed or expansions on previous ones. Certainly things like the art walks have gotten much larger, which means there's a lot more time and energy involved in seeing to their organization, a lot more people to connect with, a relationship with different community groups has grown. So from a resource capacity like that, that is also more profound. And fortunately, with the elimination of a central agency within the state, there isn't as much opportunity to seek out resource, support, help, just a pat on the back and good wishes. So you're a little more an island in the stream doing it. So that makes a bit of a difference. But we've been a very active organization to this point, which is now in our 50th year of operation.
50 years is a long time. I mean, what kinds of programming does the Hayes Arts Council put on and has it through that long history?
To be honest, with a group of volunteers, even back in its first year of operation, on a certain scope, a number of the projects that are still part of our organization were a part of our organization then. It's just without space and things like that. They'd have art exhibits in people's homes. But we were the first arts council formed in the state of Kansas following the work of a state representative who was from Hayes, ran a music store, and was also, like I said, the state representative for our area. His name was Vivian Meckel, and he is the gentleman that authored the legislation that founded the Kansas Arts Commission. In fact, in the basement of the Hayes Arts Council, I have a stack of binders probably 4 feet tall, which is the holy grail of the finding and work on the on founding a state agency, because it ran a music store. It was also very connected with the arts locally. So the arts legacy, the arts foundation of our community really has been going on for a long time. But I think it is safe to say that the Hayes Arts Council does serve as a hub for that in a great capacity. In my tenure, which will be 27 years here in September, we've expanded a lot of programs and, like I said, incorporated some new things. So that's probably been the biggest dynamic, is making sure that what we are doing is reaching the broadest constituency possible, including going out to other communities, schools, and counties, which is a newer development within our organization.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I am curious when you talk about going out into schools and things like that. I mean, tell me about the community you're serving in those places. Talk to me about Hayes.
Hayes is the big town, quote unquote, out of those communities. Hayes is a community of 20,000 people. We do have Fort Hays State University in our community, a wonderful, wonderful four-year state liberal arts university. Because of it, we are afforded some luxuries when it comes to creative, artistic, and quality of life from a cultural perspective. And that allows us the opportunity to engage and be served and have exposure to things that we wouldn't in a community of 20,000 people in a somewhat geographically isolated areas. The communities that we work with are, aside from Hayes, are the communities of Victoria, Ellis, Plainville, and Russell. They are all quite small communities. And the young people in those communities would probably have little to no opportunity to be afforded some of the things that we do bring to them.
Like what?
Some of the things. For instance, when every child in kindergarten through fifth grade, when they leave elementary school, fifth or sixth, depending upon what's in their learning center, those young people will have experienced no less than six professional performing arts events by regional or national companies in the amazing Beach Schmidt Performing Arts Center, a magnificent state-of-the-art performing arts center on the university campus. And so for young people to leave elementary school with six or seven of those kind of events under their belt gives them a springboard of exposure and appreciation to the performing arts. We work with the university on some of those things. Other things are things we bring in independently. But every year, those students have one professional, quality, cultural, artistic engagement in that capacity.
So where does the funding for that come from in the absence of a state arts commission?
There is a foundation locally that helps us with one of the theater projects. And there I have turned to in recent years more profoundly. They've been with us for a while, but we asked them to please step up their game a bit. We've got great support from community cultural organizations like the Kiwanis, the Optimists, and the Rotary Clubs, who have all, if you will, adopted one of our special youth outreach programs, programs that impact several hundred, if not thousands, of young people. That has been of support for us. There have been a couple of other community foundations, which fortunately for us have only been available to access, have only come into their own and been available to access in the last 6 or 7 years with the compromise of funding from the state because even before it was eliminated, of course, budgets had gotten very tight in most of the granting programs, unfortunately. And we have asked members to step up their support, which many of them have.
So like private individuals?
Absolutely. I've gone to other community entities to see if we can maybe find a little more underwriting here, there. Most of those gifts or contributions, donations, whatever you want to call it, sometimes they refer to it as their marketing budget, have maybe been stepped up, but none of them are huge. So our base of support is very broad because since the situations with the Kansas Arts Commission, our city government has also stepped up a bit, the monies that it gives us. It's not a huge amount collectively overall, but we are incredibly grateful. It is a huge amount for us, just not, I know what happens with some city fundings, but it's a little bit under $12,000.
You know,
and that has been able to be nudged up.
The New York Times has suggested that by taking on the challenge of making things happen without state money, you may have inadvertently made the case that the arts don't require public funding. Do you agree with that, or has something been lost in translation? Is there something that we may not be seeing in spite of the fact that you are staying afloat?
Absolutely. I refer to it in there as a catch-22. And there's no doubt things have been there's more of a concerted effort that has to go into your constantly being aware of what you're spending, how it's going, and if you're going to be able to expand programs more or engage in new ones. I would not take on any new programs at this time, and I'm not talking about my physical ability to do that because I can do that. It's about the funding effort. And yet at the same time, the last thing that someone like me and most arts administrators, the last thing I would do is acquiesce that it's difficult to make that point, so people better come back.
Wait, sorry. I didn't quite follow that.
What I mean is I would never just say, you know what, I don't want to do all the catering myself. I don't want to get rid of the janitorial service and clean the Arts Council myself. I would rather let the printing company do the layout and the design of some of the invitations so that I don't have to do that as well. So has there been reasons, occasions, aspects that I have had to go above and beyond? Absolutely. But I will do that before I will allow a program to be compromised, because I have been there for as long as I have. That's easier for someone like me to do, not because I'm brighter or better or have a better handle on things. It's the familiarity. Someone coming in new to the Arts Council would be in a world of hurt because they wouldn't have had the opportunity to establish those relationships, which sometimes go bye-bye from a funding perspective, if the conduit for a number of years isn't still there.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to jump in. I mean, I think I'm maybe following what you're saying, but I feel like a concrete example might help. I mean, what is it? Can you give me an example of a program that you think, without explaining why, but just by demonstrating it in your description, you know, like, what is it that you could have done differently, better, more effectively for the people in your community with state funding?
Oh, goodness. You know what? I know it sounds terrible and I'm not hedging, but I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. I spend my time and energy truly, and I'm not trying to be flippant, going damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And so I just keep doing whatever I can with what I've got, because that's what matters. We are fortunately a little different, and I can tell you that as a native Kansan, as a native person from Ellis County, I know that we are in a situation to continue to do whatever it takes to make it work of a certain level. Would there like to be facility improvements that we'd like to do? Of course there would, but it's about programming. But what I do know as a native Kansan and a value to the arts overall, and not a job for me in Hayes, Kansas, is knowing what this has cost other smaller communities, programs within larger agencies or smaller agencies or service groups in a larger community, that have gone under or bit the dust, not only because of the state funding that was lost, but also losing what leverage it provided to someone else who was willing to go along for the ride because you were that far into the game and had that much skin in the game. And so I just, for us, like I said, I would be having janitorial service, which means I wouldn't be working as long as days. I might be
working as long days, I should add, I mean, doing what?
Scheduling art walks.
Cleaning toilets?
You got it. Cleaning toilets, dusting, mopping the floors, preparing food, doing layout on design. So basically, I'm the director of development. I'm the marketing director. I'm the director of education. I take care of the website and the Facebook, so social media and the website, which I'm a little behind on the website because of the enormity of the other projects right now. Manually typing things that we could maybe send off to a service.
Let's hear now from Mike Morley. He is the board president for the Hayes Arts Council. And Mike, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. You know, when you hear Brenda talking about her role for that organization, but also the role of the arts in your community, what are your thoughts? I mean, I understand that you and Brenda maybe have a political difference a little bit, and I'm wondering if your take on this is the same as hers.
Surprisingly, yes, it's very similar. The reason the Arts Council has enjoyed the success that it has is because of the efforts of a cadre of volunteers and the fact that we have an excellent executive director in Brenda. And to your question earlier, well, what do you do? She manages to stuff 28 hours of work into a 24-hour day. And through the efforts, by taking on extra responsibilities and helping keep expenses as low as possible and focusing on programming, we've really been able to stretch the dollars that we've been lucky enough to have to maximum effect.
Tell me about yourself and your background. I mean, what do the arts mean to you?
Well, I grew up in Topeka, and when I look at the arts programs, limited as they were that we had back when I was in elementary school, and then I contrast that to what the Hayes Arts Council does with Hayes kids, Brenda's absolutely correct in that they get much more exposure than I think we ever did back in Topeka, you know, in the 70s and 80s. That said, my interest in public art, by background, I was in the Navy for 23 years and lived overseas for 17. And in all those countries and locations that we lived, there was always something in every city. For example, if you go to Amsterdam, one of the centerpieces of Amsterdam, and if you get on Instagram and look and see what's the most often tagged image from Amsterdam, it's always the I Amsterdam public art project. And it's basically letters that spell out I Amsterdam in the middle of a public square, about 10 feet tall, that people climb over and take photos on. It's brilliant. You go to Spain, and in Sevilla, there's cathedrals and sculptures on every block that are a little bit different, but all part of a larger theme. So as you travel around, you see the importance of art in the public space and how important it is, you know, to a city's or to a community's identity. Well, and
I want to dive into that a little bit, because we politically hear so much about communities being overlooked and in many cases losing the things that have provided identity, not just identity, but economic security, that so many of those things are falling by the wayside for Rust Belt communities, for rural Midwestern communities. And I'm interested in what you're saying in that context about public art.
Mm-hmm. Every community, you know, has its own feel, its own flavor for public art. You know, what's the art scene in New York City and what passes for public art in New York City is vastly different than what it is in Kansas City versus what it is in San Francisco versus what it is in Hayes. That said, I think it's important that we do everything we can to foster that interest and that appreciation in all mediums of art, not necessarily just public art that's in spaces, outdoors on the streets and whatnot, but also encouraging a thriving arts community and the programs that we have. for example, famous figures, encourages fifth grade kids to adopt, you know, to research a historical character, write a story, and then deliver, you know, say a speech as Theodore Roosevelt or as John F. Kennedy or as Mahatma Gandhi. And, you know, when you see a fifth grader that's willing to memorize, you know, a Gandhi speech and shave his head and deliver it wearing, you know, wearing a robe, that's something that's going to stick with that kid for a long time. And so through these programs, we develop that appreciation and that love of the arts, whatever form they happen to take.
Do you think that the bare-bone staffing model is a model for the arts in this country? I mean, it is efficient. You can't argue with that. You're talking about all of the things that have been done, and they've been done without a lot of public funding.
It's driven out of necessity. Is it ideal? Absolutely not. And to the question of does public funding have a place in the arts, I personally think it does. Just because in some communities without public funding, they're going to have a hard time getting programs off the ground. Fortunately, like Brenda said here, we have 50 years of history and experience. We know what works. We know and some things that haven't in the past that have maybe dropped off. So we focus on those things that work.
I have a question for you. Can you talk to me about your own politics and how what you just said fits into them?
Specifically how?
Party affiliation, voting patterns, and mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm a registered Republican. In the last national election, I did vote for Trump for president. That said, I am not a party line voter. I actually voted for Obama in his first election back in 2007 for the 2008. So I look at the candidates. I look to where my interests align with theirs, and then I make my decision accordingly.
I'm curious whether you think that there is some kind of disconnect between politicians and communities on this issue?
That's a very good question. It's hard to say, and I don't want to, you know, put words necessarily in anyone's mouth. But when you look at how small a percentage of the federal budget, you know, say the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, PBS is, National Endowment for the Arts, it's really a sliver. It's a fraction of 1%. And then when you look at the return on that investment, you know, how does that enhance quality of life? How does that build a sense of community? It's a tremendous ROI, in my opinion. And for the money spent, frankly, I think there does deserve to be public money spent on the arts. That said, I'm not a single issue voter, and that was only just part of my decision.
Well, when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from the director of the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence, Kansas. Her strongly worded letter to the editor of the Times argues that public funding is in fact vital in Kansas, where not just artists and arts organizations, but communities depend on it. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about how cuts in federal funding for the arts might affect our communities. A New York Times article recently profiled some Kansas arts organizations that have made huge sacrifices to stay afloat through the Brownback administration's budget cuts, calling it a test case for possible national experimentation yet to come. Sarah Lynn Reese-Hardy wrote a strongly worded letter to the editor in response to that article. She's a native of Scandia, Kansas, population 362, and her career highlights include founding the Salina Arts Center and working for the National Endowment for the Arts. She's now director of the Spencer Museum of Art at KU in Lawrence. Hi, Sarah Lynn.
Good morning, Gina.
So what's wrong with saying that if arts organizations can survive without public funding, they must not need it? It may sound harsh, but you could also say it's just dollars and cents.
Well, first of all, I feel like I need to say I'm actually representing about 17 people this morning because my letter was co-signed by 17 other people throughout the state of Kansas, and I would just encourage people to go to a website and take a look at all of their friends who are on this letter that was generated by a group of us. But in answer to your question, I have been around the arts in Kansas a long time, from early days when you were lucky to have a poet come through town and you would meet at the public library, to now where we are really part of a global situation. Scandia, Kansas is not so far from Beijing as it was in those days. And one of the issues for arts organizations, particularly in Kansas, I think, is this sense of a national connection to artistic expression, at the same time supporting thriving work in your own local communities.
That's kind of what I was about to ask you. I mean, do you think that public funding is more about the ability of artists to create or the ability of the public to have access?
That's the most important question I think you could ask, because I would say that public funding is about access. I also think it plays a role in encouraging the creative environment. It is essential for artists, I think, to have that kind of encouragement, that kind of validation, also that notice for them to thrive. And our excellence begins to escalate when the public funding is going toward artists. However, the big losers when public funding go away are regular people in our communities to have access to the best. And I think essentially it is about providing quality arts experiences to everyone, regardless of their financial situation, their ability to travel. Or is it going to be that I spend my summers in Salina or in Scandia or another wonderful Kansas town, and I am exposed and engaged with artists from around the world who are seeing life differently and expressing in new and innovative ways?
There is, as I mentioned with Mike in our previous segment, there is so much talk politically about forgotten communities in rural and small town America, especially when you get away from the coast. And as I mentioned, you're from a small Kansas town and you started an arts center in Salina. So you seem like a good person to ask. I mean, do the arts mean something different in places like Scandia and like Salina?
I think the arts mean something different in each community, regardless of size, regardless of geography. So in some ways, it's the authenticity that is provided by a local setting, a sense of place, if you will, that each community, whether it's Lawrence, Kansas, where I now enjoy arts of all kinds, or whether it's Colby, or whether it's Goodland, Kansas, close to where my mother grew up. So I also saw that when I lived in Washington, D.C. It has its own flavor. So I think less distinction about, oh, well, here are the qualities of small places and here are the qualities of cosmopolitan or bigger places. It's that true arts always reflect a feeling of their community and the people who live there, the diversity of all the people who live there. So maybe it's different in scale, but I do not think it's different in terms of what's available for artists to draw upon to create good work.
You've told me in the past that participating in the arts is a way of taking part in a larger conversation that goes beyond the borders of your own town or your own community, whatever it may be. So when we talk about public funding for the arts and who loses access without it, what does that mean for who is part of the conversation in that case?
One thing it means is, and I so appreciate Brenda, it's always like Brenda has this wind in her sail that keeps her generating.
From the Hayes Arts Council.
Yes, yes. Brenda and I have known one another for a very long time. Lots of admiration going toward her. But what happens with public funding is when you write a grant to the National Endowment for the Arts, you have to assure them that you are going to make these experiences available to all citizens. And we do that. And so what does it mean? It means that maybe if I don't have a history of going to performances, but my school is going to do that, I get to do that. Or maybe if I don't have the financial resources to travel to New York or London, I get to experience a dance company from one of those places in my own community. So what it actually means is the distinction between the haves and the have-nots in terms of an invitation to the dance. And the dance writ large is for all citizens. It is about bringing all of us into an expressive conversation about what it means to be human, how we relate to one another, and what are those questions about inclusion that become part of the demonstration of the arts?
If you live in Kansas, there's still a little time to weigh in on this, and I'm curious what the arts mean to you as a Kansan, and whether access to the arts is something that matters to you. Is it a good use for public funding? Call 816-235-2888. You know, Sarah Lynn, can you explain to me how this plays out for you at the Spencer Museum in Lawrence? I mean, if the question is, can Kansas be a test case for what happens without a robust public agency for arts funding, what are the lessons that you think can be learned from the last 6 years?
Let me tell you what it means at the Spencer. It means very recently, through a grant of $50,000 from the National Endowment for the Arts in 2015, we were able to bring artists from India, Japan, and South Korea to the middle of the country. These artists were at the museum for 4 weeks this fall, interacting with students, with the public. They led public programs. They made an exhibition. This exhibition could not have taken place in the same vital way that it did. And I also want to know that National Endowment for the Arts funding and other federal funding encourages local support. That $50,000 did not pay for the entire project entitled Temporal Turn. It began it. It was our first, it was our startup. And there, from there, we were able to attract funding. Another example from a different federal agency, that this summer, 72 high school teachers, some from Kansas and some from all over the country, will converge for a 7-day workshop about the history of race and education in America. And that focus will be on how art can help tell our stories and speak and teach students about our national history. That's a National Endowment for the Humanities grant.
So this is national funding you've received, and I think that's kind of interesting because my question was really about the absence of the state art agency, the Kansas Arts Commission. But in a way, I feel like what you're saying is partly that it is hard to treat Kansas as a test case because Kansas is still part of the nation and that you are still benefiting from the National Endowment for the Arts.
That's correct, but not having a state agency compromises our ability to thrive, and it compromises our ability as a state to rise. Anecdote, when we were responding to the letter to the article in the New York Times, somebody that we called said, "Wow, this is what happens when you don't have a Kansas Arts Commission. You lose track of one another. Our network is broken."
Wait a minute. So explain that. What was broken about it?
The Kansas Arts Commission was in play. We not only received funding, we were a statewide community of arts organizations. We would come together at funding panels. We would draw upon each other's strengths. It also compromised not only the funding in our local communities, but our ability to work together as a system.
Is that an efficiency issue? Because it's the argument on the other end is, well, if one person can do all the work to make an arts organization continue to operate in a community, then then they don't need additional support. But I also hear you saying that, on the other hand, as a larger community, having something that connects you like that gives a different kind of efficiency.
Well, and efficiency, yes, but thriving and hanging on are two different things. And hanging on and operating, opening your doors, that's very important. Thriving means you grow. Thriving means that you're aware of new things happening, that you're changing, you're creating new programs, you're adapting programs, you're aligning your program to the daily lives of students that have changed tremendously. So there is efficiency, but there is also, what does it mean to grow? And that is not to just stay in one space. So in some ways, I would say that the lack of statewide funding has inhibited the growth in Kansas that could have occurred.
Coming up, this conversation on arts funding in Kansas continues. We'll talk to a poet who won a 2017 fellowship from the NEA. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking this morning about funding for the arts in light of the fact that Trump's proposed budget for 2018 does not include funding for the NEA or the NEH. I'm talking now with Hadara Barnadov. She is a poet, and she teaches at UMKC. She's won a $25,000 fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Congratulations, Hadara.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So what have been your thoughts as you've listened to this morning's conversation so far?
That Sarah Lynn, Mike, and Brenda are my heroes. I'm honored to be in their company. I hear several different messages about the importance of national funding for the arts and really how it impacts the community. And that's also the way I think about receiving my own grant. It isn't just mine. It's also what I give back to my community. And even Sarah Lynn had mentioned our global connection. So I'm editing a journal right now that comes out of Israel. I've been, in a journal in India. And so there's this local community exchange and a national, but there's also an international. And that's one of the beauties of art, that it can transcend geography, it can transcend race, culture, and bring people together in vital conversation in ways that we wouldn't have the opportunities to otherwise.
Can you explain to me how your voice being in those journals, those international journals, brings us locally into some specific conversation?
So I was invited to teach in a conference and give a reading at Bar-Ilan University in Ramat Gan, Israel, last summer. And there were a couple of faculty members there who run a literary journal called the Illinois Review. And we connected through our art and as people. And then they asked me to edit a journal, an issue of the journal. And I've put out calls to my community of writers who are national, California, Chicago, Kansas City, and I can potentially bring those people and their voices and their work into the journal, which then goes back to Israel. So that point of connection kind of grows and grows and grows. And we're getting submissions from Korea, from Australia, and it's all bridging through art making. And so as an editor, I become a facilitator, but I was first brought to Israel as a poet.
What do you anticipate doing specifically with your grant money?
Specifically, my plan is to take a research leave from my full-time job teaching at UMKC. And my two other major goals are, one, to fund a book tour, which I would not be able to do otherwise. And two, if you didn't notice how very pregnant I am, also to cover childcare costs for a toddler and a newborn. And childcare is exceedingly expensive. The grant means I'm going to be able to write at a time when I normally would not be able to, and that I would be able to support not only the writing of a new book, but I have another book coming out in fall 2017 called The New Nudity. And so it gives me a chance to promote that current book and then also time to write a new book, which I can, as a new mama, I would not have a chance to do otherwise.
This might sound harsh, but can you make the case that public funding should be helping you with the childcare costs that make it possible for you to be a writer?
Could you ask that question again?
Well, I guess I'm thinking about just whether we may have listeners who question whether that's a public concern or a private concern. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about public funding.
Yes. The NEA guidelines state that you can use the money however you need to support your work. So that might be my particular concern. But that doesn't mean that the other people who have won NEAs are using it in that way. And I realize talking about childcare isn't particularly sexy. But I'm not just using it to have, my kids in full-time care so I could sit on a beach somewhere. It's actually so I can work full-time and on my writing. And so for me, having the grant, which enables me to afford childcare, enables me then to make art, which I share, I would argue, globally.
Can you talk about how this distinction between what funding allows an artist, in your case, a poet, to do, and what it allows the public to benefit from? I mean, talk to me about the community benefit a little bit more, not just a community of writers, but the broader community.
Well, I guess I can think of one specific example. I am very honored that I recently won an award from the Poetry Society of America for a particular poem I had written called Dress. And that poem was actually in honor of a 16-year-old who was the victim of an honor killing, Ambreem Riasat. And I, in Pakistan, and I got so much, that poem was published online on the Poetry Society of America's website, and I received so much communication from people actually all over the world stating how heartened they were that, you know, somebody from Kansas City, Missouri would take on writing a poem like this. And I have no idea if those people were necessarily writers or not. I didn't ask, but it honors the life of a young woman who helped her best friend elope and successfully get married, for which she was then bound, strangled, and put in a van that was lit on fire. And so part of my work as a writer is to honor these stories that would otherwise disappear and to then share them with whoever the readers may be.
It's interesting. I mean, it makes so much sense that what we're talking about when we're talking about a benefit to a community is not just local concerns, but local people being part of global conversations. It is a little counterintuitive, though.
So I just want to jump in because I think that in particular the arts have a coupling and uncoupling with the economic system. And one of the observations that I would make about this very moving story that we've just heard is that to be a true and dedicated artist is such hard work because you have to plumb your sense of your whole sense of what the world means to you and who you are as a human being. And then you have to craft it in this way that is legible to others. So it's being at the forge, the creative forge, day after day, exercising who you are as an artist, and then trying to translate that to the rest of the world. That takes time.
You can't be a tourist.
That takes money. And I would say, as Lewis Hyde says, that art is a form of gift in that way, that it belongs more closely to a gift economy, but the other economies have to support that. Therefore, public funding for the arts is part of that translation from the gift economy to the economy that we know.
I think part of what you're getting at, too, maybe is this question of, is this an investment in job creation, or is it about this, what can seem like a more abstract conversation about arts and ideas? And I mean, what you're talking about, Sarah Lynn, is that this is a job.
I'm talking about that it is a job with expressive impact. So when public funding goes toward the arts, the impact is about expanding our humanness, our sense of empathy, our dedication to inclusion, and maybe even as profoundly as all of those, the nurturing of a creative spirit in the citizenry of the United States of America.
I want to get back to Mike Morley. Mike, I mean, you've been listening in, and you're the president of the board there at the Hayes Arts Council, and I'm curious whether you've had any new realizations about the role of the arts and the artist in an economy, because you're not an artist yourself, and so I'm curious on about your take.
Well, I happen to agree with just about everything that's been said up to this point. I really have nothing to add or to disagree with.
I'm also curious about your, I don't know, you talked about being in the Navy, and there's an idea of, a profound idea of sacrifice and service, and I wonder whether you think that there is a parallel in the arts, or if you think that that would be overstating it in some way.
There probably is. You know, I'd rather leave it to an artist to answer a question like that as far as what sacrifice. But to your earlier question about whether or not it was acceptable to use public funding to support an artist or to allow them to create, I don't see why there's necessarily a conflict there. The public funding is essential, and I was encouraged to hear that some organizations in Kansas have still been getting NEA grants. I wasn't aware to the level that that was still occurring, but there definitely is a role for some level of public funding, be it either through the state, locally, or through the federal level.
Hadara Barnadov, you motioned that you might have that answer that we're looking for about that parallel between the Navy and the service that branch of our military performs and what the arts might do.
Possibly. There was an article I read in February that was published in the New York Times that spoke about congressional Republicans having some deep support for the NEH. So I wouldn't say that Democrats are pro or anti, or Republicans as a whole are pro or anti. There is a program called the Warrior Scholar Project, which actually helps veterans transition back into civilian life. And they go to a kind of humanities boot camp, so where they would be studying literature. And it started at Yale in 2012. And so they're helping these veterans transition back into society, process the traumas that have happened to them, and then be able to share, ideally, techniques for healing with the public.
Wow. Well, our time is up, but Hadara Barnadov, congratulations on your NEA fellowship and on your pregnancy.
Thank you.
Sarah Lynn Reese Hardy, thank you. And Brenda Mader and Mike Morley also joined us. Thanks to everyone for participating in this nuanced conversation. You can listen back at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have that ready for you later today. And you can also go and listen to all of the conversations we've ever had on arts funding through that website, kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll talk about energy. We discuss energy efficiency all the time, whether the future is in coal or some clean new alternative. But where does Kansas City's energy come from? That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. We had help today from Brian Thompson. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.